Welcome back to Balagan. The judicial overhaul seemed to be vague about some issues that Israel was and still facing, such as the Palestinian conflict. Some would say that the time when Israeli society was so divided between judicial overhaul protesters and judicial reform supporters was the right time for Palestinians to try and gain leverage in the international arena. Even though the past few months were the bloodiest in a long time, with 34 Israelis and more than 100 Palestinians dead since January 1st, 2023, the West Bank has been mostly quiet. Is that so? To get a better understanding, we have Mrs. Noah Schusterman-Dvir, Director of the Palestinians and the Region Program at Mind Israel. Noah, welcome to Balagan. It's great to have you here.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So first thing, tell us a little more about yourself, and then we'll dive in to our topic.
So as you mentioned, I direct the Palestinians in the Region Research Program at Mind Israel, which is a new consulting group. We mostly focus on strategic issues, and my focal point is the Palestinians, which is obviously inter-Palestinian dynamics and Israeli-Palestinian relations, but also how the Palestinians are integrated in the region and affected and affecting the regional trends, including Abraham Accords and a prospective normalization with Saudi Arabia. Before that, I was a research program coordinator at INSS, Institute for National Security Studies at Israel in Tel Aviv. And before that, when I lived in the U.S., lived in New York, I worked for Israel Policy Forum as a research and communications fellow. And it's good to be here with you.
It's great to have you here. And now I want you to enlighten us. Talking about the judicial overhaul, it doesn't only affect Israelis. It also affects the region. And I was wondering, first thing, since there is a lot of tension, not just recently, but mainly recently, we can see that there is a high volume of violence between the Palestinians and mainly the settlers because it's an ultra-right-wing government. There are plenty of clashes. How do the Palestinians see the judicial overhaul and the current government?
So you've mentioned a few topics that are not necessarily connected. So the issue of settler violence actually stemmed, you can trace it back to, it always persisted, but mostly till from 2021, 2022, you could see more and more events. And actually the US has been discussing this topic with Israel, which was even back then reluctant to really acknowledge the fact that there is such a thing as settler violence, and it's not a specific targeted incident. It's become more dominant, I think, because now it's not only disconnected events that maybe would reach the backside of the newspaper. Now it's getting more focal attention because these people are connected with the government, sometimes even to ministers or to high-level members of Knesset. And because of the judicial overhaul, and because there's so much attention now being brought to the settlement movement and the ultra-Orthodox, and in general, I think Israel is really kind of re-questioning a lot of the narratives, or I would even say that maybe many of the liberals in Israel are questioning some of the narratives that we have been discussing, then it highlights this issue of settler violence. And it's getting more attention, not necessarily because there are more events. The number of events has actually been pretty constant, but they get more attention, mostly because they're not dealt with. And we saw the events of Hawara, burning of the village. We saw the events in Tomosia about a month ago. There was the killing of the Palestinian boy in Bulka. And we also see that no charges are, at the end of the day, no one is being charged or not enough charges are being delivered. And yes, so people are questioning this connection between the settlement movement and how it is affected by the current government. So that's one issue. I think the other question of the Palestinians and how they perceive the judicial overhaul, that's a different issue. For many Palestinians, the judicial overhaul is really not, doesn't really concern them. They don't see it as a major occurrence in the region. First of all, because they don't see Israel as a democracy. So for them, the protesters talking about the damage that is going to be caused to Israeli democracy, that's for them, it's redundant because they don't feel that they live in a democracy or live next to a democracy. But they also feel that this is basically sort of Israel removing the mask. And in a sense, I think they're correct. And as I said before about the settler violence, it's been there before. But when you tried to talk about it before, the Israeli public at large would not be willing to listen. It was, again, seen as like a minor side incident. And now it's all of a sudden, it's really getting the spotlight. And for Palestinians, this is what they aspire to see. And they're saying, see, to the international community, they're saying, see, this is what we talked about. These are really the Israelis, not Israel that it tried to depict itself as this liberal safe haven. But it's actually what you, this government is Israel as we see it, as we experienced it. So for many of them, this is actually just a good development because it gives them more leverage in the international public opinion. That's one of the reasons they're also not doing too much with it, because they realize that at the moment, Israel is damaging itself enough. They don't really need to do anything too proactive, because if they would, that would maybe even taint the attempt. They can just showcase Israel as it is or as they see it is. And then a third topic is the escalating violence in the West Bank. And we should disconnect this from the judicial overhaul, because actually, if you trace it back, we saw the spike in violence starting in March 2022, which was during the previous government, which was the government of change.
The chain block.
And even then, it wasn't really connected to the government. It stemmed from ongoing trends in the Palestinian arena for years. I would even dare to say that I think it stems from side effects of the Trump era and some of the and the Trump plan and how it sidelined the Palestinians and really caused damage to the essence of being for the Palestinian Authority. And you can see in polls how during this time you can see a spike in the support for violence and for armed resistance. So it was something that was ongoing and it was spiraling. And in a way, it was convenient for Israel not to really do anything when it was on the low burner. But when it started firing, it was a bit too little too late.
When we look at it today, it seems, I'm going to split it to three. We have the clashes between the settlers and the Palestinians. We have the Palestinian terror that mostly goes against the civil society. And you're mentioning Hawara. I would say the riots in Hawara were counter-reaction to a terror attack on a settler. And then also the last two events, if I remember correctly, were also around Hawara, the father and the son that were murdered. And also yesterday's, the kindergarten who was traveling. No, she was in Hebron. That was a different area because she comes from Bet Haggai to Efrat.
It's a very tense area, specifically to our listeners who don't really know the geography. So it's on Route 60, which is the route that's connecting the West Bank from north to south. And this specific place of Hawara is connecting settlements which are considered to be, I would say, the more extreme. So it connects between Tzomet Tepuach and Kfar Tepuach to Nablus, to Shechem. And then you can also, if you live in what you call the back of the mountain in Gavahar, then you can also take that route and exit to go to those settlements. So it sort of brings together both Palestinians who live in Area B, even though this specific route is on Area C, but the village is in Area B. It's also,
and the village borders with the road.
So yeah, so the way it's built, basically the road goes in the middle of the village, is again Area B. The road itself is Area C. On the borders of the road, there are shops because this is a very high activity road. So there's a lot of Israelis and a lot of Palestinians who use it, which often causes traffic. And then for those terrorists who are looking for an easy target, then there are plenty of easy targets in that specific area. It's correct that some of the cases that we saw, the settler violence, were sort of a reaction to terrorist attack, but not always. So the Buka. It was a Saturday. There was no event that was ongoing. It was completely disconnected to everything else. And we saw a few other events that, again, it's one of the issues is that some, again, I don't want to say anything too conclusive, but some of these settlements, which are illegal settlements, meaning that even Israel does not recognize them and even does not distribute electricity or water or roads to those illegal settlements, they are very extreme. They are inhabited by what we call Noar Gvaot, which is hilltop youth, which are disassociated youth, mostly with no real educational support, disconnected from their families. Some of them take this sort of mission, which is to inhabit Judea and Samaria in order to do more agriculture, because agriculture is a way where you can control more land. So let's say the case in Buka, where they claimed that they were herding sheep. So they were herding sheep in Palestinian private property, or what the Palestinians claim to be private property. But then those settlers, they claim, well, this is just open fields in the West Bank, and there's no reason for us not to be herding in those areas. So this is basically what we see is just more and more friction happening, because at this point in time, the current government is not dismantling any of these illegal settlements or these outposts. And not only is it not dismantling them, it's actually trying to support them as much as possible. And there's a legislation that they wanted to pass, which would basically said that if you have 20 families living on the ground, then you would be able to pave a road and distribute infrastructure. At this point, one of the reasons that Israel is not legislating this bill is because of U.S. pressure, which realizes that this is basically a way to structure the outposts and to legitimize them.
But if we're looking at what's happening with the Palestinians in past times, mainly, in the first and second intifadas, terror attacks used to be more orchestrated from above, prior from the PLO and then with Hamas or the Islamic Jihad. And I'm not sure if there is any pattern at this point that somebody is orchestrating those terror attacks. Is that so? I mean, is everybody so silent, Hamas on one hand and the Palestinian Authority on the other hand in this case?
We should look at it carefully, because even in this, the timeline of the past 2 years, there's a changing trend. When it started in 2022, I would agree with you that most of it was not orchestrated. It was mostly due to the very low-level sovereignty that was in governance that was being implemented by the PA. It was also a cause of the teardown in the security cooperation that was not working as well as before. There was high motivation. As I said before, you could see this in the poll, that there was more motivation for violence. And then the mechanisms were not as tight as they were before. So it really allowed those lone wolves to create more damage. Shortly after that, when we saw this starting in March, Israel has started increasing its activities in Area A. And sort of as a reaction to that, we saw a new trend of organizations, what we call the Lion's Den, which started in Nablus, but there was also one in Jenin, and in Jericho. Right. So a plethora of organizations, which was their characteristic was that they're disassociated from the traditional organizations. So you could have a car with four armed Palestinians, militants. One of them associates himself with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Another one is Hamas. Another one is Al-Aqsa Brigade. And the fourth one is Fatah. They're all neighbors. They grew up together. And then they have the opportunity to cause damage. So you just need one to find an illegal weapon or to get supplied by an illegal weapon, mostly with Iranian funding. And then they would just go to check, look for the IDF posts and try to target them. And they gained a lot of support from the Palestinian public, because they were, first of all, at least at the beginning, they were trying not to target civilians. They were mostly targeting soldiers. And they were seen as the protectors, because the sort of the narrative was, okay, so the Palestinians in Area A, they experience these encounters with the IDF, which is entering in the middle of the night, but sometimes then it became also predominantly throughout the day. So they don't have any more a sense of safety. I mean, there was the case of Shirin Abu Akleh, and there was more and more cases of people who were not related to the militants who were getting also hurt and even wounded or dead.
What we call in Hebrew, bilti me'oravim.
Yes.
Unaffiliated.
Uninvolved.
Bystanders.
So there was a growing number of those, and this really, and then we could really see sort of like a spiraling effect of more motivation by these groups, which were also pushing back on the PA and the Palestinian security apparatuses. This was also a reaction of criticism to the Palestinian Authority saying, well, if you can't protect us, then we are going to protect ourselves. And then Israel was obviously really trying to counter these groups. At some point, also, the PA was trying to counter these groups, especially after there was the Aqaba summit and the Sharm el-Sheikh summit. And we actually now see almost none of the events are associated with these groups, actually. So some of them were dismantled. Most of their militants were caught either by Israel or by the PA. Some of them joined the PA. There were different mechanisms that were used in order to really bring them down. And now that the attacks that we see are actually much more organized. So like the attack that happened yesterday in the south Mount Hebron, they had the car, they had the weapons. They knew that this was a road that was often used by Israelis. They fled the scene. You can really see that there is much more coordination, and the methodology is much more reminiscent of the traditional terrorist organization, such as Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And those are actually the cases that we're seeing now, which actually makes a lot of sense because Israel and the PA have really targeted these groups, the groups of youth. But this was also sort of a leeway for Hamas and PIJ to expand their influence in the West Bank.
Before we continue and dive into the PA, Area A in the Oslo Accords, they split the West Bank into three main areas, A, B, and C. A is full security and administrative custody of Israel. B is security custody of Palestinians, sorry. B is administrative controlled by the Palestinians and security-wise by Israel. And Area C is where you have the settlements, and that's controlled by Israel, administrative and security-wise. And we'll put aside Hebron, which is a completely different story, because it also has different names. It's also H1 and H2 because of the Hebron Accords. So you mentioned Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. Where does the Palestinian Authority, the PA, stand with what's happening in the West Bank? And do we hear any different voices from Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, in regards to Israel and what's happening?
So I think, again, I kind of notice a change in the attitude of the PA. When this escalation started, the PA was basically saying to Israel, you want our security cooperation and coordination, but you also need to give us political gains. And this was after, again, this was after the Trump era. This was after a long period of little to no communications between the two sides. And really, the Palestinian Authority was diminished in terms of its public legitimacy and also diplomatically. So they really insisted on regaining some of their reputation and control. And Israel was obviously, mostly due to political reasons, was very reluctant to do so and basically said, if you're not willing to do the security coordination, then we'll just do it. So Israel started entering the cities in Area A. And I would mention that it's worth saying that, yes, what you've now described about A, B, and C, that's basically the accords, the interim accords. On the ground, there is little to no difference between A and B. Israel really tries to stay out of Area B if it can, because it's better for Israel that the PA, the Palestinian Security Apparatuses, would enact security there. And in Area C, it's true that it's both administratively and security-wise Israel, under Israeli responsibility, but the Palestinians who live in Area C, so that's about 150,000 Palestinians, they actually subscribe to Palestinian administrative control on some aspects. So welfare and education and healthcare. So they're not part of the Israeli system. They don't have any kind of residentship or anything, but they live under sort of a semi-Palestinian and Israeli control, which really makes them the most susceptible to the grievances of the occupation. They're the ones who are really, like, when you hear of most of the incidences, mostly happens in villages in Area C. But this, what we're talking about now, was basically a shift, because basically since the Second Intifada, Israel has tried to remain out of Area A and really tried to, there was sort of a formula between the IDF and the Palestinian Security Apparatuses saying, the more the PSA, the Palestinian Security Apparatuses, do, the less the IDF does. And both sides knew this is the formula. So also it was in the best interest of the PA to really showcase and demonstrate its ability to serve security. So this was the formula. And then we can recall that after Trump released his deal of the century, Netanyahu, the same day, basically threatened or claimed that he was going to annex the Jordan Valley. And that's when the Palestinian Authority basically said that we are stopping all civilian and security coordination with Israel, and they severed ties for about 6 months. And this was a genuine severance of ties, highest level to lowest level, little to no communications between the two sides. And actually, a lot of the trends that we see now in terms of the escalation in the West Bank can be traced back to then, because that meant no intelligence sharing, no joint operations. So it was much more difficult for the Palestinian Authority to operate on the territory when it can't coordinate with Israel. But it was also more difficult for Israel. So some of these cells started growing during that period of time. And then COVID also helped it, because it required more patrolling and enforcing of closures, and then problems of personnel with the Palestinian security apparatuses. And basically, there are a few reasons of how we came about to this situation. But at the end of the day, this formula of the more that the Palestinians do, the less Israel does, it wasn't relevant anymore. We saw this escalation start. And what the Palestinians said from their side was actually, if you want us to intervene, then give us something. Like, you can't expect us to only be the security officers of Israel. This was already when the Palestinian security, when the Palestinian Authority was suffering from very low public legitimacy, also because it's considered basically collaborated with Israel. So they said they were not willing to do it anymore. But still, it's important to remember that Abu Mazen, as a Palestinian leader, was never promoting terrorism. And he was trying to the best that he could to counter the terrorism. But it's fair to say that at that point, he didn't mind as much if some terrorism was infiltrating Israel, because this was a tool to create more pressure on Israel. But Israel, from its end, didn't say, okay, so we understand the importance of the Palestinian Authority, so we're willing to cooperate with the Palestinian security apparatuses. But it actually said, okay, so we're just going to do more, and we're going to enter Area A. We could really see sort of like about a year of Israel entering day in, day out into Area A, and the PA doing nothing in Jenin and in Nablus. You could, though, say that now this is really in the process of changing, because Israel engaged in its operation of House and Garden in Jenin about a month and a half ago. And I think that was sort of a wake-up call for the Palestinian Authority. A day after the operation ended, there was a delegation of high-level office, high-level representatives of Fatah and the PA, who went to share their condolences with inhabitants of the refugee camp. And they were yelled at and shunned away very blatantly. And I think this was a wake-up call, because they were not only being sent away by Hamas operatives and by PIJ operatives, but also Gudei Al-Aqsa and Fatah affiliates. So that was a realization that they really started losing their own crowd. And if they don't get their act together, then they're going to lose parts of the West Bank, just like they lost the Gaza Strip.
Who are they going to lose it to?
Hamas and PIJ, which has really grown more and more dominant and basically used the vacuum of the less activity by the Palestinian security apparatuses. This was just an opportunity to increase their presence. And this connects to what I said before, that now the attacks that we see, because the PA and Israel have really tried countering the groups of youth, they're no longer connected to these groups. Now it's much more traditional, orchestrated terrorism that we knew from before, that has the motive, that has the opportunities, that has the funding, and that has the directive by these larger organizations. So we're still in the process. We're still seeing how this really envelops, but it's not a linear process. And the PA is showing much more cooperation throughout this process at this point, because it's realizing that also it has something to lose, not only Israel.
The position of the Palestinian Authority is really complicated. On the one hand, they need to collaborate with Israel in order to maintain some sort of level of living for the Palestinians. While on the other hand, every act they do, the Palestinians see it as helping the Israelis and not helping them. On the other hand, it goes for a long time that many Palestinians see the Palestinian Authority as a corrupted organization and as an organization that doesn't really help the Palestinian purpose. And when we're looking at what's happening today, especially, you know, if we're talking about the current government, also you have some elements in it that not just not helping the Palestinian Authority, but somebody like Bezalel Smotrich, who is a minister at the Office of Security Affairs, he actually came up with a program that is called in Hebrew, Tochnit Ahra'a. I forgot the name in English. When he's literally saying that we should ban the Palestinian Authority and take control back on the West Bank. And so what's the relevance of the Palestinian Authority at this point? And what are Israel's interests in keeping it alive, I would say? And what are the Palestinians' interests in keeping it alive? I know that it's a really big question. It can be a whole episode as itself, but if you can give us a glance, it will be...
So your statement from before was very accurate. The Palestinian Authority at this point is really, it's a double-edged sword. Any kind of cooperation that it does or coordination that it does with Israel is very damaging to its own public reputation facing its own people. But also it has to do it, because at the end of the day, if the PA allows Hamas and PIJ to grow in its territory, then it means that that's going to backfire. So they can't allow this to happen. And they also, in terms of their international credence, they don't want to be, again, associated with terrorism. In order to have relevance in the international arena, they want to show that they are the underdog, and the underdog cannot be enacting terrorist against civilians. It doesn't play well. So they do have the interest in really controlling the level of violence. But the more that they do it, yes, that they lose the relevance with their own people. And this really brings to question the entire concept of the two-state solution or any kind of potential separation between Israel and the Palestinians. And this kind of connects to the plan that you talked about by Smotrich. I think they call it in English, maybe the determination or the decisiveness program.
Something like that.
Yeah, where he basically claims that Israel can be decisive and determine the fate of the conflict by being strong and basically giving the Palestinian three choices. Either you're with us, and basically you accept the rule of Israel under one united territory, which includes obviously the West Bank, or you're
but become against a second grade civilian. It's not exactly being a civilian, it's actually being getting residency.
It's accept the fact that this is a Jewish state and you're part of a Jewish state and you're doing so as a resident, not as a citizen.
Not as a civilian.
So it's very similar to the situation in East Jerusalem. But then in the West Bank, you have 3.5 million Palestinians. In East Jerusalem, you have about 400,000. So the numbers are really staggering. Or you can decide to leave and we will help you relocate to a third country, which is very questionable because I'm not really sure which third countries are openly just going to say, oh, Palestinian refugees, come join us. And then the third option is if you're not leaving and you're not joining us, then we're going to fight you. So in a sense, this just, it's a bloodbath. And he claims, okay, we shouldn't be scared of this bloodbath. We have the ability in terms of ability to portray power and to use force. And we can...
No matter what the costs are.
No matter what the costs are, because it's a greater good for the Jewish people. And this is what we have to do in order to maintain our control over the West Bank. So that's what he's trying to push for. And obviously, he's not doing that per se in his position. So he has a portfolio in the Ministry of Defense. So he can't really do that because there is a Minister of Defense who is trying to keep the calm and keep the stability on the ground. But what he did request was a specific file of the civilian administration, which the power that he has using this file is basically that he controls demolition of Palestinian houses and Jewish houses in Area C. So he can basically say, we are now stopping to demolish all these outposts, these illegal outposts that are on maybe Palestinian private land or don't have any kind of authorization to be constructed. So we're not going to do anything about them, but actually we're going to help them as much as we possibly can. But whenever Palestinians are building outside the permitted area, then we're going to demolish the houses. And it becomes even more complicated when we think about the fact that in Area C, there are a few villages. Obviously, as I said, it's about 150,000 Palestinians who live there. So there are villages that are in Area C, which they can't grow anywhere because they don't have zoning permits because the civilian administration is the one doing the zoning and they don't authorize any of these zoning plans. So for the Palestinians, so anything they built is necessarily illegal because they can't request the permit because there's no zoning plan to request it based on. And then the other type of demolition that happens is basically villages or cities from Area A and Area B that are spilling over because natural growth, they're spilling over into Area C. So like we say in Israel, there is natural growth, so you have to make sure that the settlements have the room to grow. This does not apply to the Palestinians, and they don't have room to grow. And if they surpass their limits and they start entering Area C because of it's a seam zone, then it's demolished. So that's the portfolio that he controls. And if before that, this was a professional portfolio and the civilian administration, which was under the Minister of Defense, but it was basically a second arm to the IDF. It was under the realization that if you want to counter terrorism, then there's force, but there are also civilian motivations. And there's economy and there's welfare. And those are things that can also affect a person's motivation to partake in violence. So basically, the civilian part of it was sort of removed from the Ministry of Defense. It was given to Smotrich, who is not really intent on utilizing it for calming of the situation because he doesn't really care or he's not very afraid of an escalation. Because if you really kind of drill down to his own agenda, to his ideas, to his ideology, then he realizes that at the end of the day, this is going to go into a battle. So there is no use in pushing back. On the contrary, let's do it now. So you see in the coalition, in the Ministry of Defense, there are conflicting voices. And Netanyahu, at the beginning of this current coalition, he was on the sidelines. He was allowing Smotrich a lot of leeway, I think, in order to placate the coalition, because, you know, they sold to the public that this is a full-force right-wing government and that it was going to do things different than the previous government, which actually the previous government was very much in line with all of the Netanyahu governments before that, if you look at in terms of the Palestinian issue. So he was trying to, Netanyahu this time around, was trying to depict a different policy. So he was giving a lot more maneuvering power to Smotrich, but then it started to backfire. And it started to backfire because of settler violence, and it started to backfire because of increased international pressure, including also the U.S., and the security situation, which is really becoming more and more tense. And now they kind of renewed the previous policies. Now they've started talking again about the importance to strengthen the PA. But this is coming too little too late, because these past 6 months, they have not been about strengthening the PA. Smotrich, who on his other hat is also the Minister of Finance, he deducts funds from the PA. It's becoming more and more difficult, I think, under this coalition for Netanyahu, who at the end of the day mostly cares about not even security, but stability. He wants to ensure that at the end of the day, things are calm and quiet. So that way he can move his policies vis-a-vis the US and the UAE and Saudi and those are his major, and obviously Iran, and that's his major interest. He doesn't really care about the Palestinian arena so much. He just needs it to be as cool and calm as possible. And I think at this point, that's why he and Gant are kind of trying to take back the reins from the Ministry of Defense and have more control over the cabinet and the financial decisions and the security decisions concerning the PA.
I'm tempted not to ask you about, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. I'm tempted not to ask you, what does the Palestinian think about the U.S. and Saudi Arabia negotiations, you know, that they will have a diplomatic accord with Israel and they will gain nuclear reactors and stuff. We'll put it aside. But there is a growing, actually, conversation within Israel. First thing around the settlements and the price of and the toll they take on the people, I think that that's a voice that I never heard before from the mainstream of Israelis, who are saying, you know what, the religious Zionism is messing with us, we are not going to send our kids to defend them in the West Bank. And there are actually growing voices also talking about splitting the land, a new two-state solution, not between Israel and Palestinians, but actually between Israel and Judea, which means that they're going to leave the Palestinians and the settlers together. I'm not asking you about the Israeli point of view on that, but do you hear anything that Palestinians are thinking about, you know, what's happening in Israel in that term, like about the solutions offered?
So the Palestinians, again, they really, I mean, they follow Israeli politics and they follow, obviously, because of the proximity of the two entities, and interactions. They know what's going on most of the time. And if you look at Palestinian news outlets, then the majority of what they cover is Israel affairs, but they don't really have an opinion. Because again, for them, everything is kind of the same. They live under an occupation. They feel that their civilian rights are being infringed. They don't really have a sort of a clear statement on how things should go. I do think they'll be sort of coming back to what you tried to not ask about, which is the issue of Saudi. I do think, and this is kind of, I'm going to say this with a grain of salt, but I do think that maybe the Palestinian leadership is willing to think, to rethink its attitude towards normalization, because it really suffered from the way that it reacted to the Abraham Accords, losing a lot of money also because of it by the Gulf states. And also realizing that this is going to happen with or without them. So they might as well have some leverage and maybe make sure that they can ensure that their issues and their interests are being taken care of. To what extent or capacity, that's a different question. But I would say very carefully that I wouldn't be surprised if there is Israeli-Saudi normalization, then it would have a very strong Palestinian component and the Palestinian would be accepted. Because at this point, they really don't have anything more to gain. They're kind of losing on all fronts. Hamas is trying to position itself in the West Bank, as we talked, PIJ as well, which it's not in a good place. And they really need, at the end of the day, the PA needs to show something to the Palestinian people. And the reason of existence of the PA is because it was supposed to pave the way for statehood. And the reason that it's so unpopular now is because Palestinians are looking at the situation and saying, what statehood? There's not, like, look at the amount of settlements. Go on Route 60 and see how there's so much construction of Jewish settlements and no construction of Palestinian houses. So they're really sort of disillusioned by this two-state solution concept. And the flip side of not believing that this two-state solution is feasible is then, okay, so what do we have? Then we live in a one-state reality, which is an unequal one-state where Israel controls the resources and the money and the people. And that's where they find themselves fighting. And, you know, some young Palestinians just say, we don't mind joining Israel. If Israel doesn't want a two-state solution, that's fine with us. We're willing to accept Israeli citizenship. You know, we're even willing to accept Israeli residentship. We'll be like those East Jerusalemites. But they realize that looking at the numbers if now Israel would give 3.5 million Palestinians, and this is not counting Gaza Strip, which is a whole different story, but only looking at the West Bank, Israel now gives 3.5 million Palestinians residentships and not citizenships and annexes the West Bank. And basically there's a one state entity between the Jordan River and the sea. This would inflict a lot of international pressure on Israel. And talking about democracy would be relevant. And it would obviously be a big interfere with the relationship with the U.S. And Israel would not have the support of the U.S. under these circumstances. And so they look at that future and they're not scared of it because they know at the end of the day, they would get their full citizenships. It would not be in Israel. It would be under a new entity that they would have more control of. They believe that the international community would not be willing to continue supporting Israel under these circumstances. Maybe they're right, or maybe they're just hopeful. I hope that we don't have an opportunity
to test it,
yes.
Oh, definitely. I agree with you because it's against the Zionist dream of having a nation state for the Jewish people. But it doesn't seem that the Israeli government is too worried about it at this point, or maybe they're not spoken about it.
The Israeli government is not really concerned by anything that's long-term. The Israeli government, yeah. And this is, I mean, it's relevant to this government, but it's relevant to most
previous
Israeli
governments.
Yes, it's very, focused on the here and now. And they need to make sure that they're able to excel or to even withstand the next 4 years without devolving. So unfortunately, yes, Israel lacks a long-term strategy vis-a-vis the Palestinian arena. And what we see today, the trends that we see today, is a side effect of the lack of strategy, of thinking that you can continuously manage the conflict. The Palestinians will be willing to not have any kind of political horizon, but also not have independence, and they'll be okay with it. And that's a paradigm that I think at this point, it's really been shaken.
Noah, thank you very much. There is so much that I can talk to you about, but we leave it for other episodes. I'm really grateful for the time and for all the light that you shed on us in regards to the Palestinian arena. And I'm looking forward to having you again as our guest at Palagan. So thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for joining us for another episode of Palagan. If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Palagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Palagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.palaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Palagan.